My name is Jody Kretzmann, and when I'm not doing the program director's job here at Holden, I direct an urban studies program in Chicago and have been involved in electoral politics anyway for more than 20 years, mostly at the city level, but sometimes at the national level. I have been called by the Chicago Tribune a political operative, which as far as I can understand it is somewhere near Cook County Jail inmate in the in the pantheon of Tribune aphorisms. Yeah. So I really am a sort of addicted political type, and that has made this an awfully difficult summer for me. I have never been this far from a Democratic convention, or from a Republican one for that matter. Usually I either have a role at one or at least am glued to the media. Partly as a result of the distance between Holden and anything real in the world, I really find myself taken aback at the attempt to be an expert of any kind tonight. So one can't paint oneself as sort of being on the inside of any conversations or the purveyor of the latest gossip within either party, which means that when one is at Holden, one is forced to take the longer look, the sort of look over the longer horizon. Rudy thinks in geologic time. In politics, the longer look is sort of 6 months, right? Sometimes 6 years and sometimes a couple of decades. But what I want to do, I think, is to just make a few sort of contextual remarks to you at the beginning, and then to open it up, hopefully, for some discussion about what you think may be important, or in fact, unimportant, about this particular election year. Stepping back from the headlines for a few moments, I'm not going to say probably very much that lots of you don't already know, but let me try to put it into some kind of a context and some kind of a framework that makes some sense. It's always good to be alliterative, so we'll talk about strategies and substance and symbols in the 88 election in those kinds of orders. It seems to me that probably most of our concentration, and I'm going to concentrate on the presidential elections at this point. I think if we want to talk about the relationship between the presidential and other both local and state elections, we certainly can do that. But let me concentrate at this point a few remarks to open up on the presidential. Makes sense to me to start with strategy simply because that's most often the meat of what we get from the media. The media are interested primarily in politics as a horse race in the U.S., the U.S. media are, and they're interested in personalities as a part of that horse race. As much meat as you can get from the media usually has to do less with both substance and certainly symbols than it does with strategy. Strategies are really, insofar as there are think pieces done in the media about elections in the United States, they are most often done about political strategy. So let me open with a few remarks about strategy and how I see my colleagues in the Democratic Party and what I know about the Republicans thinking about this particular one. Political scientists, most of you probably know, are at least some political scientists recently have been thinking about what they call pivotal elections or benchmark elections. That is a year in which some sort of major geologic plate tectonic movement takes place right, in the American electorate, where the agenda shifts in some way, where there are visible major constituency shifts that may have some lasting kind of impact. And one of the questions to ask then about 1988 is this that kind of benchmark election? I'm not sure about that, but we can think about it for a couple of minutes. We're talking about, for instance, elections like 1932 with the election of FDR, and really the whole introduction of a different way of viewing the state and the role of government, at least in the United States context, borrowed from a lot from Europe at that point. We're thinking some political scientists include 1960 in their list of benchmark elections, but more include 1968, the traumatic year of the Democratic Convention in Chicago, where in the aftermath of the nomination of Hubert Humphrey, Richard Nixon began to put together really the Republican coalition that has held together for the last 20 years. The 1932 FDR coalition was made up, if you think about it, of labor, white ethnics, blacks and other people of color, and the solid Democratic South, right? Nixon, in 1968, broke off a good chunk of the South, right? And a good chunk beginning then of the white ethnics, leaving Humphrey really without an FD, you know, Humphrey is ironically the sort of quintessential Franklin Delano Roosevelt candidate, unable to put together the FDR coalition. Well, what Nixon put together in 1968, more or less by accident, it seems to me, given the accident of the Vietnam War and other events of the late 60s, has really held together through the 70s and the 80s, I would argue, with the brief parentheses of the 4 years of Carter, Jerry, but it really was a sort of parentheses. If you think about the election of Jimmy Carter, it really was a kind of exception. For one thing, Carter was in many ways more of a Republican than a Democrat, ideologically, and he was from the South. And therefore, he was able to put together enough of the Southern elements of that strategy to get himself elected. Well, the question then for 1988 is, what's going on? What are people thinking about, particularly from the Democratic side? It's clear enough what Bush is thinking about. Bush would like to put together all of the elements of the Reagan coalition. That 1968 fragile coalition that Nixon put together was sort of solidified in its ultimate way in 80 and 84 by Reagan. Is it possible for George Bush to keep that kind of coalition, which has built itself into more and more of middle America, together in 88? Well, what's Dukakis thinking about? It seems to me that there are some new elements to Dukakis and his strategists thinking about what they want to put together in 1988. They're at least worth looking at briefly. If you look at the Electoral College, what Dukakis is trying to do, obviously, is pull together the northeast section of the country with the northwest section of the country, add California and Texas, and about a half of the Midwest industrial and farm states, right? That will give him the 270 electoral votes that he needs to be elected. How do you do that? Well, he's counting, it seems to me, on the northeast and the northwest, having enough of the elements of the old Democratic coalition, plus some new ideologically oriented politics, more at home out here in the Northwest. He's counting on California and Texas with Benson and the Hispanic vote. It's interesting that this is the first ticket in the history of the United States to speak Spanish. Both of them speak Spanish fluently. And he's counting on enough economic hardship in the Midwest, the troubled industrial and now farming states, to swing back over into the Democratic column, to put him over. What does that mean in terms of constituencies? He's counting heavily on Jesse Jackson, it seems to me, to deliver not only the normal Democratic black vote, but the kind of additional black vote that only Jackson, it seems to me, is capable of delivering, increased at least probably by 20%. In terms of registration and turnout. He's counting on a higher percentage of Hispanics registering and voting than have ever turned out before. He's counting on an increased gender gap. If you remember 4 years ago, the Democrats were banking quite heavily on a gender gap. That is, the fact that women tend to vote more liberally on social issues domestically and more liberally on peace issues, and therefore swing a little bit more toward the Democratic Party than men do. And that preliminary polls for this time around seem to indicate that gender gap has widened since 84, and that in fact it is now no longer, as it used to be, a gap between married women and single men. Now it's a gap between married women and married men. So, good luck, families. And he's also, it seems to me, Dukakis, counting on re-wooing not only some of the labor vote, but a good deal of the white ethnic vote that deserted the Democrats, basically on social issues, and as I'll say a little bit about in a minute, on symbolic questions for the Reagan candidacy in 80 and 84. One other way to think about that the Democrats, it seems to me, have been taking very seriously, judging from the speeches at the convention and what we've been able to hear about the platform so far, is thinking about the new collar voters. People heard about the new collar voters. It's a term that was coined in 1985 by a friend of mine named Ralph Whitehead at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Used to be a Chicago journalist. New collars is in contrast to blue collar workers. New collar families are families which are usually dual income. They are lower middle class yuppies. When you think about the generation of the baby boom, most of the press has been about yuppies. Ralph is suggesting, and other people are too, that the much larger population of people between the ages of, say, 25 or 30 and 45, the baby boom generation, the larger part of that population is really lower middle class. In the new service industry jobs, having to take two jobs per family to make it, and really struggling to make ends meet, worried about a variety of family issues like daycare, like education, simply the old issues about how you make it in the American economy, the new collar workers. No longer blue collar, they're not in the older industries, but neither are they doing as well as sometimes the professionalized version of the yuppie vision says that the baby boom generation is doing. Let me just, one of the nice things about, one of the addictive things it seems to me about thinking about elections is that each of the elections sort of spawns a new vocabulary. Another way in which people this year have begun talking about new collar voters is to talk about TICs. Have you heard about TICs? Two income couples with kids. So that both the Republicans, both Bush and Dukakis, are worried about now how to get at the TICs for 88. You notice Dukakis, the first place he went after the convention was over was a huge white Baptist church in St. Louis to talk about family values in precisely that demographic group that the TICs come out of. There are some, let me digress for the language for just a minute. The references that each of the parties makes to the other candidates are always fun, too. My favorite so far about Dukakis, the Greek descended governor of Massachusetts who does have a charisma problem, is Zorba the clerk. And those of you who, unlike us, got to watch the Democratic Convention, probably heard Adam Richards say about Bush that he was born with a silver foot in his mouth.
With a southern drawl, he said it.
Yes, yeah. I think when you think about the strategy that Dukakis has to put together in order to win for the first time, and Democrats have won once in the last five elections. When you think about the strategy he has to put together, I have to, anyway, be so far very impressed with what he's done. It seems to me that his basically cautious profile, his statement that this election is about competent management, not about ideology, at one level that might strike some of us who care about issues as a kind of cop-out, but it seems to me when you think about the political strategy of getting elected in the United States in 88, that's a perfectly understandable kind of stance. When you think about his caution in terms of the vague platform, apparently all attempts to get anything very specific into the Democratic platform were rejected. When you think about the choice of Benson, about which we might want to talk a little bit, at some point, and when you think about the kind of fencing that Dukakis has been doing with Jackson, all of these point to a kind of creation of a cautious profile, which is designed to pull in a huge number of contradictory elements into a Democratic coalition that has not really been pulled together in the last 20 years, with the exception, again, and I think it really is an exception, of Carter. Okay, enough about strategy for the moment. We'll see what Bush comes up with, by the way. I'm not sure that, Bush at this point is counting on the residual Reagan strategy to be viable yet once more, and I'm not sure that it is. One of the things we might want to think about is that a strategy that is transferable beyond the kind of personal charisma and the still very high regard personally in which that president is held to somebody like a George Bush? We'll see. A word or two then about substance in the 88 elections. What is this about? certainly probably one of the most important ways of thinking about elections is as a way of setting the national agenda, a way of thinking about what it is that is permissible in the public square to talk about. What can we talk about as part of the common commerce, the common conversation that we can have about as a public? Elections help us do that. That's part of what the ritual of the election is about. It seems to me that we are in 1988, at the end of at least 8 years, where a kind of constriction of the public conversation has happened. That is where the tone set from the top and the definition set from the top about what it was okay to talk about, what policies were okay to explore, whose problems got treated seriously at the table, where that set of conversations really became quite limited and quite constricted, where it was okay to talk about private ways of addressing problems so that people who were skilled in the therapeutic mode of dealing with problems, or people skilled in the philanthropic mode of dealing with problems, or in corporately addressing problems, private industry, foundations, and so on, even churches, that it was okay for those groupings to be involved in conversations both as contributors to the definition of the problems and as contributors to the solutions of problems. But that, in fact, when we thought about our public life together, when we thought about the role of government, when we thought about the public sector, that was an increasingly constricted set of expectations. It's safe to say, I think, that this president has succeeded in probably more than any other president that I can think of, certainly in this century, in lifting up one strain of what it is to be an American, and that is the kind of militant libertarian individualism, and lifting up that version of what it is to be an American as the sort of iconographic center of our conversation, right? And it's therefore very difficult to talk about community as well as difficult to talk about the public realm. He has been, Reagan, it seems to me, has been in fact so effective at shaping the flow of our conversation that we are, most of us, unaware of the fact that the public sector, that whipping boy of at least the last 8 years, really the last 20 in lots of ways, has continued to expand, both in numbers of people working for it and certainly in terms of the dollars allocated to it over the last 8 years. One would think that after 8 years of this kind of turning away from the public agenda to a privatized agenda, that there would be some kind of concrete evidence that such a movement had happened, and there really isn't. So what specifically does this shift of the consciousness of the American people, which I think has been really pervasive and pervades the Democratic Party too? It's one of the reasons Dukakis can't sound like a New Deal Democrat after Reagan. No Democrat, really, with the exception of somebody who really is from the outside like Jesse Jackson, can sound much like a New Deal Democrat after Reagan and expect to be elected. What have these sort of abortive expectations of government meant, briefly, domestically and in terms of foreign policy? Let me just tick off a couple of things. It seems to me that the major thing that's happened in the Reagan years particularly is that the areas in which it's always been true that private enterprise in advanced industrial capitalism has not been effective, that is, private enterprise has been terrifically effective in lots of areas, in our economy and in our life as a nation. Some areas it has never been effective. Those areas have been, since the New Deal, the province of government to take care of. In the Reagan era, those areas have been neglected. I'm thinking particularly about things that private industry simply is not good at doing. Low-income housing, for instance. Job training and preparation, for instance. Basic education. Basic public education, care for and repair of infrastructure, that is all of the stuff that's under the grounds and the bridges and the highways and the public good sector of the society, energy and environment issues, lots of areas that affect the poor, such as health care and family supports. In general, there's no clear way for private enterprise to make a profit in these areas, and that's always been true. There's nothing surprising about this. But when government pulls away from it, as they have in the last 8 years, it simply means that those areas themselves become increasingly an unmet agenda for the American for the American public. And it seems to me that that's part of the legacy that even George Bush is addressing. George Bush's first major address, I hope some of you saw over the weekend after the Democratic Convention, was a very specific set of proposals for a massive government-funded daycare program, right? $2.5 billion to a business women's organization. So that even Bush and the Republicans, it seems to me, are going to be recognizing in the upcoming campaign a kind of agenda that has been created by the neglect and the constriction of the state in the last 8 years under Reagan. Let me just say a word in parentheses here about what it seems to me on the domestic front anyway that it is a salutary legacy from the Reagan years. I do think that some of the gut libertarian feelings that Reagan expresses so nicely and so persuasively have had a salutary effect in lots of ways, particularly his anti-bureaucratic diatribes. I couldn't agree more with his anti-bureaucratic diatribes, and I think it's probably something that New Deal Democrats had to learn, and in fact have learned. I also myself, anyway, resonate fully with a lot of his decentralist emphases, so that insofar as what Reaganism has been about in its libertarian strands has been about devolving power from the center out to the folks to make some decisions, it seems to me that that probably is an interesting, at least in a place like Chicago where I work, it's an interesting base of bubbling up activity out there to work on. And now with some resources, if there were a Democratic administration, that would be an interesting set of factors to work with. Well, let me just say a quick word about the linkage between the domestic questions substantively and the foreign policy questions, and then a quick word about the foreign policy questions. The linkage, of course, is the military budget. As the domestic spending has gone down, the military budget has escalated, particularly in Reagan's first 5 years. It's now begun to level off, at least to levels of increase that are comparable to the Carter years. Obviously that has been the practice of voodoo economics, as George Bush called it in 1980, and it seems to me has led inevitably to the rising deficit and to a number of problems related to the rising deficit. What does the military budget mean about the inherited kind of agenda that we have in foreign policy in any more global kind of context? It seems to me the inheritance from the Reagan years, very briefly, in terms of foreign policy, is a kind of tunnel vision, a kind of monomaniacal fascination with the Soviet Union, which I think, in fact, in the last year has led to some positive results, but nonetheless has focused us for 7 years on seeing the world as a Moscow-Washington, D.C. axis, and has led us to, misread when we read at all the dynamics between North and South. And what in the world has happened in the last 10 years, and really probably 20 years, but 10 years anyway, with the kinds of issues that Jerry Barney has been raising with us in the last week or 10 days. Obviously, it seems to me the context in a global setting has shifted dramatically in the last 8 years, that all of the indicators, as Jerry has been telling us, along our ecological path to disaster, along the kind of critique that asks questions about the limits of growth, that all of those factors have continued to escalate on a global kind of basis, and that in fact nobody in Washington, D.C. in any positions of power have even been addressing those issues. The one issue that we hear about in the environment area that has gotten on the agenda at all in the last 8 years is acid rain, and the only reason we hear about that is because the White House has been asking for more and more studies rather than any activity on that front. So it seems to me that there's a whole part of the necessary central global conversation which has not even been on the discussion agenda for the United States in the last 8 years. And therefore, this election, insofar as it reopens, rewidens, rebroadens that conversation, could be terrifically important. Also, it seems to me in the last 10 years we can see huge shifts in the relationship of the United States to all parts of the globe on a political and economic basis, and therefore a need to rethink our political and economic relationships with the first world, with the second world, and with the third world. Think about that over the last 10 years. Think about the unthinkability of a united Europe, say, 10 or 15 years ago, of the challenge to the dollar that the yen has presented over the last couple of years, of the crash last fall in our stock market and the consequent strengthening of all of the other currencies of the world over against the dollar. We are so clearly, in relationship to the rest of the first world, the developed industrialized world, in a whole new ballgame of a cooperative, globally interdependent economic setting. And our politics drag way, way behind that reality. In our relationship with the second world, our relationship with the socialist world, both Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, as well as the People's Republic, it seems to me that we can give Reagan slightly higher marks here, but that there are possibilities as more and more of our agendas become the same between second and first world, there are more and more possibilities for breaking down the 50-year sort of hold that anti-communism has had on our imaginations. It seems to me that we may in fact have Reagan to thank for that finally, but it seems to me that one of the most important things that could happen in terms of waking the United States up to a responsible leadership position for the 21st century is a rejection, finally, of simple-minded anti-communism into some kind of a view of a variety, of wide variety of systems that the Second World represents, and a wide variety of challenges to us that it represents. And in relationship to the Third World, briefly, it seems to me that the complete lack of, certainly of empathy and even of understanding of the Third World for the last 10 years has been appalling. That and it started under Carter, I'd have to say. Our policies to a good deal of the South, although his human rights policies were certainly something that was admired both in the Second and Third World. But it seems to me we wake up now 10 years later with the United States having considerably less power over countries in the southern part of the globe than we had 10 or 15 years ago. We are in a relationship of unmanageable debt. Barry will be talking about that a little bit later on in the week, between the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere, and particularly the first world and the third world. And it's a debt that no longer accrues to our benefit since it's unpayable. And we are clearly in a world now where the third world takes for granted its independence from United States hegemony. Where are the creative responses to these new realities? Totally new relationships to first, second, and third world. Where are the creative responses? Will we have a foreign policy kind of discussion that takes these new realities into consideration this time around? I'm not sure, but it does seem to me that we absolutely need that. Okay, finally, just a word or two about symbolic politics here. I'm fascinated by symbolic politics. What I mean by symbols in political life. Symbols are signs pointing to and understood by many as pointing to something of larger significance. It is true at one level that politics is the art of who gets what, where, when, and how, right? That it's about concrete benefits and the distribution of power to get those benefits. But politics is also about communicating with symbols. It's about establishing reality in a kind of symbolic framework. And it's one of the most fascinating, it seems to me, elements of our political life. Symbols can be people. In fact, large numbers of public people, by virtue of being public, do in fact carry a kind of symbolic dimension with them. Politics can be thought about as the art of forging new symbols and adapting old ones, right? The creative politics both forges new symbols and adapts old ones. Think about the symbolism of the last couple of months in presidential politics. The kind of dance that's gone on between Dukakis and Jackson, where the most significant moment or non-moment was the lack of a phone call, right, informing Jackson of the choice of Benson for vice president. That's we're talking here purely in the realm of symbol. purely in the realm of symbolic activity. It would make no difference at all in the outcome of any event, whether or not Jackson had known that in time. Both Jackson and Dukakis, it seems to me, have made this an interesting 6 months because both of them are masters. Turns out, surprisingly, Dukakis is a master at manipulating symbols. In fact, Dukakis' major attempt to broaden his appeal in order to rebuild the old Democratic alliance, it seems to me, is a symbolic effort. He's not talking about where exactly, he's not going to make a proposal like George Bush did over the weekend about $2.5 million for billion dollars for daycare. He really is trying to recapture some of the major national symbols that have been the property of the Republican Party over the last 20 years. He's trying to recapture the flag, he's trying to recapture family, he's trying to recapture a community. Let me say just a word about that. Dukakis is the most ethnic candidate that we've had for president in the 20th century. Think about it, the son of Greek immigrants, married to a Jew. With both Kitty and Mike Dukakis carrying their ethnicity and their roots, their communal and religious experience with them right up front, and beginning to use that symbolically, beginning to use that as a way of defining community, of defining opportunity within community, of defining tradition in the United States in a way that affirms pluralism. Certainly in a way of trying to define humility in terms of roots. Mike Royko had a column over the weekend. Something there that's beginning to resonate with lots of people who might, in fact, be interested in reestablishing some idea of community in the American culture. It's interesting to me, too, that at least when I was in Chicago this spring, Dukakis, among the white candidates, stood out in the minds of the black folks precisely because he was the only one of the other six candidates who had noticeably ethnic roots and who was coming out of a noticeably communal kind of tradition, and there was some kind of resonance already going on between Greeks and blacks in Chicago, which is pretty rare. And this is a contrast. We're at the level of symbolic politics. We don't know what this means substantively in terms of money, but it really is a contrast to George Bush, who is in many ways the sort of ultimate resume, the ultimate sort of waspish, we can't even tell which state he's from. He stands for competence and bureaucratic experience. And I think there's a part of the American public to which that appeals quite deeply. But we're going to have some contrasting, it seems to me, symbolic interchange between what Dukakis is trying to paint as his central core and what George Bush will be painting as his, as his central core. We'll see how that plays out. Finally, just a word about Jesse Jackson, and I hope we can get some good conversation. Jackson's the candidate that I've been most involved with in Chicago for the last 20 years. Chicago is clearly Jackson's toughest audience. He's made more enemies in Chicago than he has anyplace else in the country, and so we are all probably more critical of Jesse than we are of anybody else in the race. At the same time, I think we recognize the sort of unique talents that he brings to the race. Let me just say a word or two about what I think is Jackson's significance symbolically in the way that we've just been talking about it. He has managed to capture within himself, symbolically, the kind of essence of the marginalized constituencies of the United States in 1988. There is no marginalized constituency out there that doesn't have a sizable Jackson contingent within it, and that's really quite an amazing accomplishment for a black movement leader. He, in a sense, he embodies without even having to say it, although he certainly says what he wants to say quite beautifully often. He embodies, because he stands for the marginalized, a whole domestic set of priorities and agendas, which he almost doesn't have to say anything about to communicate to the constituencies that he's connected with. He also, I think, interestingly, and we don't think about this as much, he embodies a different kind of foreign policy. Those people from outside the United States that I've talked to in the last year, when it's been clear that Jesse was running again, have talked about Jesse as the most exciting thing going on in American politics. And I think that globally, that's clearly the view. I also think, frankly, at this point anyway, if I were to be writing 10 years from now a history of the 1988 elections, that that at this point, historically, the most significant thing that has happened in 1988 is the emergence of Jackson with the kind of 7 million votes in the primary process that he received. But the way in which he's viewed globally can't be underestimated. The way in which his very appearance at center stage has altered the view of the entire Southern Hemisphere, I think it's fair to say, of the American political process, I think is quite profound. The view of the shift of Jackson himself has been marvelous and interesting to watch. I think it's problematic in lots of ways, but not many people make the shift from charismatic movement leader to savvy political strategist. I don't think he's entirely there yet, but he sure is in a different place than he was 10 years ago. And it's interesting to watch somebody shift worlds as often and as skillfully as Jackson does. The question about Jesse is what's going on with him now? What will he do? Burt Lance told him to disappear after the Democratic Convention, and Jesse's never been able to do that. I don't think he'll be able to do it now either. But he's caught in an interesting place with both opportunities and dangers. The dangers, I think, are dangers of co-optation, are dangers of being too close to the center to do what he does best. The dangers are being, therefore, too marginalized to be close to the center to be effective. So he's got a very interesting and, I think, unprecedented tightrope to find in the American public life. It's interesting to be facing an election where only part of what you're really interested in, or at least only part of what I'm really interested in, will be decided on December 8th. Part of what I'm really interested in is what in the world does American public life do with a Jesse Jackson after November 8th? So we'll see what happens on November 8th, and then we'll ask the question, where's Jesse? And where's the rest of you? Let me stop. I've already talked too long. Where are the rest of you? What's important about this election, and what do you want to raise of the millions of things that I haven't, or criticize? Yeah, Bob?
Well, it seems to me that the most remarkable analogy Jesse used in his speech at the Democratic National Convention was the analogy of the cook. That is, that you have all of these particular groups, none of which are large enough to do the job, but when they're all sewn into this quilt, they become one big piece that's large enough to keep the body warm.
Mm-hmm.
And by walking a tightrope between Benson and Jackson, I think Dukakis has, in effect, said, and that was triggered by your remark about the ethnic sort of emphasis in the Dukakis and Dwight Kennedy, in effect said that that quilt is the Democratic analogy, that we can put all of those pieces together, and when all the pieces are together, it's big enough to do the job. When apart, they are not big enough to do the job. And what was marvelous to me was probably the most significant thing that happened in the Democratic Convention never happened on the floor. It happened in those private conversations of how are you going to handle this business of the Jackson and Dukakis tension.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how that got resolved, and the way in which now I think the quilt can be put together.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, just to underline the importance of Dukakis fencing with Benson on his right and Jackson on his left. I mean, when I wrote a piece in January about the seven, at that point, seven Democratic candidates, and it was clear to me that you talked about Jackson in one set of categories, and then you compared the other six, and of the other six, Dukakis was clearly the most liberal, you know, clearly the closest to Jesse in everything that we knew about his public record at that point. Barry knows his record from Massachusetts, and to see Dukakis pulling himself toward the center with and positioning himself quite consciously now between Benson on his right and Jackson on his left, distancing himself enough from Jackson to be accepted by the mainstream of the Democratic Party and by, in fact, the power brokers on the right of the Democratic Party, has been a skillful kind of expansion of his credibility, really, within the Democratic Party. And the other thing is, you know, the quilt thing is just one example. I mean, nobody weaves nobody weaves visual images like Jesse, right? Yeah. Really, you just can't do it. Yeah, Jim?
The other thing is that talking about strategies that the Democrats had going all the way along through the primaries that Bush did not, is that Bush wrapped it up early.
That's right.
And by Jackson staying in there, the attention was continually called to the Democratic candidates, and Dukakis in that process looked more centrist than Jesse did. And the debates on television, you know, they were both saying the same thing, but they said them in enough different ways that the perception, and the symbols again, were Dukakis is this competent, the consummate yuppie that you see people working in Silicon Valley for Apple Computer who are, you know, I'm working 70 hours a week and loving it. That's what that is. Work and George Bush identify with that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we could talk for a long time, too, about the...
Even though he is.
So far, the Democrats have won the battle of the media. And insofar as we are talking about the centrality of symbolic politics, we're talking about media politics partly. And, you know, because you need a public for your symbols, and the media do transmit those. And so far, it seems to me clearly that the Democrats have won that battle. Joel?
A question for Jody about what do you see as the substance of the Dukakis presidency, as apart from the symbol he's trying to create? I mean, this movement to the center... Will he have to preserve that for some time into his presidency? How do you see that?
Well, let me just say a couple of things about it. I think that it'd be, I mean, there are a lot of things to say both domestically and in foreign policy about what I think a difference would be. We've got a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate at this point. It seems to me that for areas that lots of us care about, Central America and South Africa, for instance, the changes would be significant and fairly quick with a Democratic administration. My guess is, though, that in terms of the perception of movement, that any Democratic president, after a popular presidency like the Reagan administration, which has so constricted our conversation, needs to move very slowly and deliberately, and will. And Dukakis knows that, I think. The experience that Barry can tell us about from Massachusetts and from the friends that I've talked to in Boston is that we can expect Dukakis. Dukakis is not a guy who is afraid of surrounding himself with talent. So we can expect bright, good folks. I mean, in the administration, and so he will not surround himself with incompetence. He ran a clean administration in Massachusetts. He is not, from all the Massachusetts dope we've got, an initiator of policy as much as he is a responder to constituents that bring him stuff. And I think that that's probably what we'll see on the domestic front. Some of you may have had the experience, let me just say one other thing about that. It really came home to me again. I was down at the Council on Foundations convention doing a talk in May, and I was struck in that world, Jerry, about the existence of a kind of government in exile that has been around universities and foundations for the last 20 years, and with the exception of yourself and a couple of other people who got in the Carter administration, but even that was sort of foreign territory. But there's a whole government in exile out there that was reared in the Kennedy and Johnson years in the 1960s that's been sitting around think tanks and trying to think up what works and what doesn't work and so forth. So there's a sort of dam ready to burst of policy stuff that will be very hard, it seems to me, for a Dukakis administration to resist. I think it could be interesting, although he's a cautious character.
Mm-hmm. What I'm finding real interesting, Dukakis is using the media to his advantage right now. And I'm wondering what Bush is going to do to counteract that, how much Reagan is going to play on Bush's side. And I guess what I see Bush possibly doing to alleviate that is picking some dynamic person like Kirkpatrick or Dole for his running mate.
It's a possibility. Elizabeth Dole you're talking about, not Bob. Talk to the Kansas people about that. Yeah, I think that one of the election that the Democrats like to compare this to is 1960, where you've got a young, relatively unknown Massachusetts politician, John Kennedy, running against a sitting two-term Republican vice president, Richard Nixon, in 1960. Lots of people say that there are a lot of factors why Kennedy beat Nixon in 1960, not the least of which that my city, you got Chicago, stole the votes that put him over the top. I've always been proud of that. But a lot of people say that one of the dynamics that led to Kennedy's victory was the fact that Eisenhower, who had his differences with Nixon, but Eisenhower still a very popular incumbent president, sat on his hands and did not go out and stump for Nixon until really the last moment. The last couple of weeks, Ike went out. And that doesn't seem to be what's going to happen with the Reagan presidency. Clearly, Reagan, I think, it looks like at this point, is going to be out after the Republican convention, stumping for Bush all over the country, so that there will be at least that kind of difference. Any Topeka people with Dole experience here want to talk about that possibility?
Yeah, no,
yes, sir.
Well, I think the caucus is very aware of what he's doing with the centralization. I think it's been kind of minimalized. I think it's really no accident that he's becoming more, offsetting Jackson and becoming more in the center of the party and becoming not as liberal, especially with picking Benson as a candidate, as a running mate. I think he even goes further with the symbols of the 1960 election that you just talked about with, you know, the Massachusetts, the Boston Austin connection, yeah, sure, as they've been calling it. And basically, I think he's been looking for that all along. And I think that's something that the Republicans are going to have to deal with. I mean, obviously, George Bush thought he was going to carry Texas until, you know, 2 weeks ago. And mm-hmm. Now he's faced with a whole different ballgame. And I think Dukakis really has been thinking about the Kennedy years all along, and I don't think it's been any mistake, as this conversation seems to be kind of like it was just an accident that happened out of the media. I think he was very aware of it.
No, I think you're right. Mm-hmm. Jed?
Well, you've explained, I think about as clearly as I've ever heard, the importance of symbolism in campaigning today. I appreciate what you did. I'm impressed with it. But I'm left with a question, a wonder. And that is the business of symbolism, the role of television, I think, in requiring quick one-liner answers to everything and simplifying things so much, in some ways, remove substance from our campaign. It's even removed substance from things that happened during the course of the tenure of the administration. There's been, for me, an amazing amount of tolerance of absolutely inane things that have gone on. Total ignorance on the part of some of our most senior leaders, including the president. Now, I think that's unhealthy for our country. I think it's unhealthy that we're going into this election with so little attention to how seriously out of order our economy is. I think it's dangerous for our country that we're going into this election with so little understanding of how our influence in throughout the world has declined. It reminds me of England several decades ago when they ceased to be the great international power that they were. And it took England a long time to come around understanding that. And I think it's taking the United States at least an equal amount of time to discover that we are not anything like what we used to be. Now, a way in which substance is going to emerge in the course of this election? Do you see a way in which substance and some kind of education of the public generally is going to take place after the election? How do you deal with the fact that the public is so out of touch with what's going on?
That's a really interesting question, Jerry, and one obviously we could spend a couple hours on. Let me just make one comment about it. It seems to me that it seems to me that it's still helpful to think about the centrality of symbols in one way of beginning to get at your question. That is, how is it that you can begin to think about a reconception of what America is, of what the United States is, and do that in a persuasive enough way that the American people can adjust to the changed conditions that we find ourselves. And clearly we are not the power that we were in the 1950s and 60s. Clearly we need to readjust our way of thinking about our interdependence globally and what we have to offer globally. My own view is that the major export, morally, the major export that the United States has at this point is precisely its multi-ethnic character. Precisely the fact that we are still a nation of immigrants, that we are still this patchwork quilt that Bob was talking about, of peoples. No place else in the world is like that. When Reagan thinks about that, that is talked about, and really lots of Democrats too, that's talked about as a set of problems. It's the immigration problem. It's the bilingual education problem. It's the poverty in the inner city problem. It's the Indian reservation problem. It seems to me that partly it is a question of communications at a symbolic level to get the American people to rethink who we are and to turn our value judgment about who we are totally on its head. Right? That we're no longer the exporter of the white man's destiny. Right? We are the exemplar of a global community, struggling to make intercultural reality, multicultural reality work. You go to any of our major cities, that's what major cities are about these days. Major cities are microcosms of the globe in lots of ways. That's what makes them so much fun. And U.S. cities are unlike any other cities in the world in that way. Right? So part of it is, it seems to me, an adjustment to a different kind of reality based on a manipulation of symbols about that reality that is beginning to happen. It's happening awfully slowly, though. And it has to have substance following the symbolic manipulation of the communication. Back here first. And then you had your hand up before, right, in purple.
I was just going to say, I feel that you talk about all this, but it's really the practice of election to lose for two reasons. One is, the Democrats are going to be hungry this year, as they were in 76. They worked as hard for Hoover in 68 as they did for Carter, particularly labor. Jimmy Carter, or Hubert Humphrey would have been president, but they weren't hungry. They had 8 years of Democratic administration. Now they've been up all but 4 of 20 years. And the other is George Bush. He was born with a silver foot in his mouth, and he just doesn't project. His body doesn't fit his voice, his mannerism, and those things. And he can't go out and reach that conservative constituency that Reagan had, because he can't reach the evangelicals. He can't go preach right the light, burn his full of conviction. He's a blue blood Episcopalian. He just can't go out and talk to those people with conviction. And they'll either do one of two things. They'll probably sit on the sideline, which is the same as voting for Dukakis.
Mm-hmm. You may be right. Certainly the convention was, with all of the democratic harmony that we saw, was one major piece of evidence about how hungry the Democrats are.
They didn't need so much harmony in that convention. They need to portray competence, which they have not portrayed mm-hmm. in the convention for at least 76.
Did you see the convention? Did they portray competence, do you
think? Well, I saw only Jesse Jackson night. That's mm-hmm. We were in France and we were here. Mm-hmm. So
the press coverage afterwards seems to give them high marks on that. I mean, they seem to have recognized that what this was not a convention where, you know, debate and contention was at the center of the stage. It was a primetime TV production, and they treated it that way.
TV played with them because they didn't cover it. I read this. I didn't see it. They didn't cover it. They let the soaps go on during the day. They didn't cover all the platform mm-hmm. arguments and all that.
Mm-hmm. It's 2 hours a night.
The only grudge was they couldn't shut off the governor of Arkansas.
Yeah. Governor Clinton will never be asked again. Yes, sir.
I think one thing that people have become to be educated on, though, if you touched on it, and that is, will possibly Democratic administration provide financial support for things that we that the community has taken hold of. 4 to 6 years ago, the churches in Portland, we were scrambling to help the homeless. 2 to 4 years ago, we were jumping through all the city hoops that they were laying in front of us to try and provide housing. 2 weeks ago, we had a meeting, and there were about 14 of us churches involved, and they asked how we were doing with the filling out the permit forms and all this stuff, and one of the speakers of the group stood up and said, well, my church alone saved this city $47,000 last year housing the homeless. We'll get the permits done when we're, you know, when we get around to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least within the community of Christians in the Portland area, we're becoming not the fundamentalist active, but, you know, active on the social level like that, that we weren't even 4 years ago.
Sure. I think there's a lot of that bottom-up bubbling going on around in places. It'd be fun to harness that in some way. Another hand. Hey, Jim?
Responding to Jerry's question about this, about substance, you know, the substance of the issues are only carried on by really a very small percentage of the people. Most people that do vote on the basis of symbols, and about only 60% of the people at max vote at all. And then you have 10% of the populace that is functionally illiterate, can't read a newspaper. And then there are millions more who don't read the newspaper. I was appalled once when I asked my congregation when I served in Southern California, people raised their hands. Did they read the Los Angeles Times the other day? How many people read the Los Angeles Times? We bought 3-4 hands out of a couple hundred. Mm-hmm. Now.
So that a lot of this is a contention among elites.
Yeah, and the people who vote, and the people who vote, they'll vote on the basis of perceptions of what George Burton, like the gentleman back here, said. That's what people vote.
I think that's right. One of the arts of politics is how you take complex realities and reduce them to sort of popular and graspable.
20-second television bite.
Not a mean art entirely. Yeah. Somebody over here. Yes.
I didn't say a word. Won't speak for Kansas, but there's just some interesting things going on with that. And my notion is the most Republicans in Kansas just seem that Bob Dole not be vice president.
Is that right?
In the sense that they see that George Bush losing, and he would not with them. But the other side of that is Bob Dole has been quoted, apparently, not Bob Dole has been quoted, but some of his aides have been quoted that he wants to run, assuming that George Bush is going to lose, and he'll have been a good boy, and he'll be lined up for 4 years.
Okay. That's an interesting scenario. A little hometown cheering from Kansas.
What do they say about Liddy?
Well, everybody loves her. It wouldn't matter. Yeah, mm-hmm. They would be proud if she would be.
Well, Vespers calls. Back to the kingdom of the left. Thank you all.